Hello, I'm Jason Solomons, and this is Film Weekly. On this week's show, I'll be meeting British director Sharon Maguire, best known for the international hit Bridget Jones's Diary, now releasing her latest film, Incendiary, starring Michelle Williams and Ewan McGregor. I get all 80s, don my best black leather and apply just the right amount of eyeliner as I delve into the world of Depeche Mode and its mad fans with a new documentary by Turner Prize winning artist Jeremy Deller and his co-director Nicholas Abrahams. And Zan Brooks will be back to tell us about the London Film Festival Week 2 and some of the other films on release nationally this week, including Ricky Gervais in Ghost Town, High School Musical 3 and Nanni Moretti's hit Quiet Chaos. But first, Sharon Maguire is still best known as Bridget Jones's best mate Shazza and as the director who pulled off the marvellous feat of adapting Bridget Jones for the big screen, proving in the meantime that Renée Zellweger could do a jolly good English accent. With her second feature film Incendiary, Maguire has done a 180-degree turn, moving from comedy to tragedy. The film, starring Ewan McGregor and Michelle Williams, follows the complications of an affair caught in the violent events of a London terrorist bombing.
I've got breaking news for you.
Have you seen a little boy? Excuse me, did you see a little boy?
Please go.
The death toll as a result of the Mayday bombing.
Sharon Maguire, welcome to Film Weekly. How lovely to have you in our pod.
Thank you. I've never been in a pod before.
No, but it's a beautiful place to be, especially if you've got a new film out, which was also at the London Film Festival and is also on general release this week, Incendiary. Michelle Williams plays a good old Cockney girl. Why?
Because I think she's a fabulous actress and because I think she has a sort of raw vulnerability and a humour, which I wanted. And an English girl could have played it, but I wanted her. Yes. And she just had a child when I was casting around, and that felt important to me because the person she plays is a mother.
Absolutely. So. It strikes me that we knew that she did a good English accent. Did you see her film that she did, Me Without You, with Anna Friel, which is a really good little film set in Brighton, and she just made an English accent perfectly then?
Yeah, I think, yes, she was playing a sort of middle Englishy accent. And I thought she was English.
Yeah,
I thought she was fantastic and thought, oh, if I ever make another film, I must keep her in mind for it. And then she popped up in Brokeback. I saw that when I was in Toronto and thought, God, she's done fabulously well for herself, that English actress, because I didn't know then. So it was only after Brokeback that I found out she was American. And then when we were casting around for this, I thought, aha, she can do an English accent, and she's great. Yeah. So,
but you of course did that transformation of English accents and American actresses really well last time in Bridget Jones.
Yeah.
People were going to say now that's what you do.
Yes, they might say that's what I do, and it does give one a lot of sleepless nights because you don't know if you're going to get there with accents and things. And a sort of it was not exactly East End, but a Cockney accent was a little bit. You know, it's a hard one to get. Really.
Yeah, it's hard for us to get.
Yeah.
Really.
Speak for yourself. I can do it. But, it is a hard one to get. So it was a bit worrying at times. And she was worried too. But, you know, she works really, really hard. And I think she got there.
Yeah, it's kind of crucial in the film because it's very specifically set. She's in like an Arsenal fan. And the film takes us into that specific world. Where did you come across the story? Because I know it's based on a novel by Chris Cleave. It's a novel, I have to say, that I didn't know at all until I saw it in the opening credits of your film.
Well, there's probably a reason why you didn't know it at all, because it came out, and when it was due to come out, Chris was going to be hailed as the next Bret Easton Ellis. And it was a book about a terrorist attack in London, and it was a book very much about London. And it came out on 7/7, so it... that's why you probably haven't heard of it, because all the marketing was pulled, all the posters were pulled off the tube, because it was felt to be, I guess, there was a worry that it was in bad taste.
Because you must have had that feeling, I presume, about making the film as well, that maybe it was too soon or maybe it was too close to the events of July the 7th, because your film literally shows a quite extraordinary attack on, I think it's Highbury Stadium at the time, but it looks more like the Emirates Stadium. It's a London football stadium, but it is Arsenal Stadium.
It's a London football stadium, yeah. So, yes, when we started the project and when I read the book and when he actually bought the rights and started adapting it, it was very much a what if. What if there's a terrorist attack on London? Mm. And then, you know, what if became a reality? So that was quite strange because I think the book had certainly... it was slightly more apocalyptic. There would be a terrorist attack, and then there would be curfews, and things would really get apocalyptic.
Yeah, it was like the Blitz again.
Yes, it would get apocalyptic. And of course, it happened, and that didn't happen. You know, Londoners just got up the next morning and put the kettle on, yeah. So got back on the tube, and so it was. You know, and in a way that chimed with what the book was trying to say, that survival is hardwired into us, so perhaps we'd better find a different way to communicate with each other than, you know, blowing each other to bits.
Because, I mean, I say that that's what your film's about, but it's about sort of a lot more than that, really. And Michelle Williams, which is why we started talking about her, she's the centre of what it's... Because it seems to me it's a film about survival, as you mentioned there, but then grief as well, and how you incorporate that into your future and into your survival and carrying on with the guilt and the grief, because, of course, she has... it's not giving too much away to say that she commences a relationship with Ewan McGregor, who lives opposite, and feels very bad about that.
It's a very... it's a woman's story, a very emotional woman's story, but it has a political context because she lives in the world we live in now, of London that we live in now, which is, you know, it taps into all our fears about terrorism. It's quite an insane world we live in at the moment.
So what was the way into the book for you? Because, I mean, of course, just, you know, everyone knows you adapted heroically, it must be said, the first Bridget Jones film, not the second one, but you heroically did the first one that had a huge hit with it. That was 2001, a long time ago. Mm. People must have been saying to you, well, you must come. Oh, you know, that's, to do a big Hollywood hit, I mean, you must have been kind of flavour of the month everywhere. Your star must have been high. You know, why did you wait 7 years to choose a very small, low-budget kind of British independent work to go into?
Well, it was kind of by, I guess, a bit by accident, but because I did go to Hollywood after Bridget Jones and was attached to various films, and then I got pregnant, so I didn't do it. So I came back home and, you know, had baby, and then when baby was 9 months old, this book landed on my doorstep, the manuscript landed on my mat, and it was because I had said to agents, can you send me the opposite of romantic comedies, please? Because I just quite like to see what they're like.
Yeah. And were you flooded with chick lit adaptations?
Yes, yeah. Very much so. And you know, I was doing a couple of them, but then I got pregnant, and so.
So you weren't a chick lit in Look for Love anymore. You actually had the kind of thing that the chick lit is supposed to happen for.
Yes, and I was a mum, and I was, you know, living in North London in the shadow of terrorism, and this book about a young mum. Well, young. Yeah, about a young mum living in the shadow.
It's radio, they can't see.
Living in the shadow of terrorism, you know, dropped onto the mat. And so I guess on the surface, they're very different. Bridget is very different from Incendiary. But both I had a connection with. Bridget was very much my life then, and almost like the life before, you know, 9/11. That's what life was.
Frothy,
it was all,
and all about love and weather.
It was all sexual neurosis, yes. Relationship neurosis. That's what we had to worry about.
Yes, there was nothing important as such to worry about. You know, life was buoyant. Life was good. There was, you know, it was whether you could get Hugh Grant or Colin Firth or reindeer jumpers for Christmas.
Yeah, little pants, big pants. Yes. You know, those
these are the crucial questions of our time.
That's right. I think when you become a mum and after 9/11 and after 7/7, life changed for us all, and it's all got a lot more serious. And just from a personal point of view, that, you know, Incendiary did connect a bit with my life.
Are we going to have to wait another 7 years for your next one?
You know, you might. Because, I don't know, I hope not. It was just like I'd left motherhood very late, you know, and I had to catch up on a bit of that. So that was all that was behind it. But I quite like to be doing more stuff, and I quite like to be writing more stuff because that chimes in a bit better with life. Directing takes you away for a long, long time from your life.
I think it's a fascinating piece of work, Incendiary, Sharon. I wish you the best of luck with it on its release. I don't think it's going to do as well as Bridget Jones did, though, in terms of money.
No, don't tell me that.
Just let you down gently. But thank you very much for coming on Film Weekly, and best of luck with the next 7 years.
Thank you very, very much.
My thanks to Sharon Maguire there, and her film Incendiary is on release across the UK from Friday the 24th of October. Joining me now in the studio is roving Guardian film critic and reporter Zan Brooks to review the week's other releases. Zan, welcome to the pod. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Excellent. Good to see you. Good week out at the film festival.
It's a giddy whirl out there, isn't it? It's very nice to have a moment of calm.
Yeah, exactly. Welcome to my womb. This week we're going to be looking at Ghost Town, starring Ricky Gervais, Quiet Chaos, starring Nanni Moretti, and High School Musical 3. I know you're all chomping at the bit to know what Zan and I think of that one. But let's start with Ghost Town. It stars Ricky Gervais as a dentist in Manhattan who goes in for a colonoscopy and gets more than he bargained for. 7 minutes of death, meaning that after he comes back to life in Manhattan, he can see dead people.
I understand. I get it.
What? What do you get?
You. Just this whole self-loathing thing.
No, it's you I loathe.
Oh, please. Frankie spent some time on the couch. You know, dentists have one of the highest suicide rates of any other profession, but this might really give you a chance
to connect
with another human
being. Shut up, okay? Really... Don't you understand? I like what I do. Do you know why? It suits me, because 90% of the people I come into contact with have cotton wool shoved in their mouths. I'm not interested in their political opinions. I don't care what they thought of Spamalot. I don't care about their lives. I just like the quiet!
Zan, Ghost Town, Ricky Gervais' first big lead in Hollywood, and a Hollywood romantic comedy at that, opposite Tia Leone and Greg Kinnear. Can he hack it?
Well, this is the real poison chalice, isn't it? It's the setting the bar very high. I'm mixing my metaphors already here. but can he swim that ocean? And he can, I think. There's been a lot of British comedians who've tried this trick, and most notoriously, you know, people like Lenny Henry and Rick Mail, who tried to do the big American film and crashed and burned.
What was it?
Drop Dead Fred. True Identity with Lenny Henry, where he was kind of in white face. The pond is kind of...
And Dudley Moore, of course,
corpses.
Has sort of... Was
Dudley Moore kind of did it, though, didn't he? And Billy Connolly when it was tried. So, it's been done before and it's never generally very successful. And yet Ricky Gervais, I think, kind of does it.
They do love him there, don't they?
They do love him. The Office spin-off, the American version, has been a huge hit. And he's been in Night at the Museum and things like that. So he's getting a kind of Hollywood profile, but this is his first lead. To make... To set the bench even higher, it's a romantic lead. It's basically a straight romantic comedy, this. And Ricky Gervais maybe isn't your obvious choice for a romantic lead, but he copes pretty well with it.
He plays a dentist called Bernard Pincus in it, which suggested to me that it was a kind of Jewish comedy and he was a dentist.
Maybe it was written as that.
It seems to me that the actual finished product, because of Ricky Gervais in it, and clearly he's ad-libbing and there's a lot of Ricky Gervais in it, it surely wasn't that. This is probably not exactly what it was supposed to be.
A little bit of kind of friction, I think, between what the script is and what Gervais brings to it. And the friction is sometimes very interesting and sometimes awkward. You feel that it's kind of pulling in different directions. There's a little bit of a kind of a war going on there. Gervais is never quite cutting loose as much as you want him to. And yet at the same time, he is ad-libbing. He is kind of throwing in a few riffs and there's some nice little grace notes here.
Tia Leone is the woman he sort of falls in love with as he's trying to convince her not to marry the Batman because the ghost that Greg Kinnear plays is telling her not to. It's all rather convoluted sort of stuff. I thought there was a sort of Woody Allen-ish setup.
Yeah.
It reminded me slightly of... I've seen Ricky Gervais in interviews sort of invoking Manhattan and Annie Hall, but actually reminded me more of Alice, which is a sort of more supernatural thing.
Absolutely, or Play It Against Sam with where Humphrey Bogart, the kind of the ghost of Humphrey Bogart kind of advises.
Exactly.
There's a bit of that there. I mean, there's a lot of reference points to this film. The one that I kept thinking of is, have you ever seen Topper, the old Cary Grant film?
Oh my word, yes, absolutely. And it has that classic kind of setup too.
And it's kind of nicely done. And yes, the Woody Allen setting, certainly with the slight take of Manhattan that's in there, this sort of slightly airy kind of autumnal Manhattan playing out around them, is quite nicely done. It's not a great film. It is schematic and the ending is a little bit cheesy, but it's not bad.
It's directed by David Koepp, I noticed.
Yes.
I hope I'm pronouncing his name
correctly.
Koepp, who I haven't looked at his filmography of late. I mean, he's a screenwriter as well.
He did
Indiana Jones script.
And I think Jurassic Park.
Absolutely.
Well.
But he's also directed a film that I meant to talk about last week, where we were talking about Kiefer Sutherland in Mirrors. Mm. Do you remember? He did a film called The Stir of Echoes, which was a Kevin Bacon movie, a blue collar Chicago movie. Kevin Bacon obsessed by ghosts in
the back
garden.
This is the lighter version of Stir of Echoes, isn't it?
Absolutely.
This is the tinkle of echoes.
Yes. Not bad. I thought I laughed quite a few times in it. I didn't think it was entirely worked as a film, but I did laugh at Ricky Gervais and kind of wished he was back here doing stuff for us.
Yeah, I like Ricky Gervais a lot. I mean, I think there's always that classic thing, and maybe it's a sort of very British trait that when somebody gets very big and then goes over to Hollywood, you say, well, he was rubbish anyway. He's terrible. You know, he's a one-trick pony, blah, blah, blah. And certainly his comedic repertoire is narrow, but within that narrow repertoire, he plays it beautifully.
Yeah, one-trick pony, but it's a funny trick sort
exactly.
of thing. Let's move on to Nanni Moretti, an Italian auteur who we're used to seeing making films like Aprile and Dear Diary, The Sun's Room, Caro Diari, La Figlia, Standard Ophelia, which won at Cannes. Moretti, normally a writer, director, and stars in his own films. Here he is starring in somebody else's film. The film is called Quiet Chaos, in which he plays a man who has experienced grief. He saved a woman from drowning, but meanwhile his wife has had a heart attack, leaving him the single father in charge of a young girl and trying to oversee a television merger at the same time. Zan, Nanni Moretti, are you a fan of his?
I am, actually. I think he's very good. You know, they say he's the Italian Woody Allen. Mm. We keep going back to Woody Allen on this.
It all comes back to Woody.
It all roads lead to Woody. But, you know, there's something more to him than that. I think there's a sort of poignancy about Nanni Moretti, which here he kind of plays to the full. And Quiet Chaos, or Chaos Calmo, which sounds so much better to say Chaos Calmo.
But because it's the yin and the yang of it, isn't it? It's the calm and the chaos. Right? Yeah. So they haven't got that quiet.
Exactly. You know, here he's basically playing a similar role to the role that he played in The Sun's Room. He's a grieving husband and father who, after his wife has died, keeps a sort of lonely vigil outside his daughter's school. And then in this kind of slightly kind of magic realist sort of way, the world starts coming to him. So there's this huge merger going on, but then, you know, because he's sitting there on the bench, people kind of come to him to try and negotiate this. There's a very strange and surprising cameo near the end from Roman Polanski as the sort of the big overboss of this merger who suddenly appears. So you've got basically two great directors in front of the camera working for a director who I'd never heard of before, called Antonello Grimaldi.
Yeah, it's first film for him.
And you know, it's nicely done, and I like Moretti. I like his kind of, the sort of poignance about him. He's not the sort of, you know, the lovable clown. He's not Roberto Benigni.
No,
which I think
thank
people
goodness.
Kind of expect him to do.
Yeah,
sometimes.
But he's got the hangdog look to him. But there's a warmth here, I thought, perhaps missing from some of his works. Although I love The Sun's Room, but it is the saddest film I've ever seen.
It's unbelievably
I'm weak through it, but I love it. He also is a director who insists on driving, be it on a scooter, be it in a car with his family listening to music. I mean, there's a lot of that in this film as well, driving around Rome.
Yeah, there's a sort of everyday quality to Moretti that I like. So he always looks slightly harassed, slightly kind of, you know, in a rush.
Yeah, he's got a meeting in an hour. Can we get his own
and there's
done
a slight
with?
Sort of frown there all the time. And yet there's a real kind of warmth and a humanity to him.
I have to say that this is the sort of film that we don't do very well. It's kind of European bourgeois.
Oh, it would be excruciating if we
wouldn't
did.
Wouldn't it? I mean, with TV executives, kind of, and jean designers and actresses. We'd hate every single one of them.
We'd hate them all, and we'd hate the message. The message is this sort of slightly life-affirming, you know, will he find love again? Everybody falls in love with him because they see him keeping his lonely vigil. And you'd have Hugh Grant playing it, and everyone would hate him.
Yeah.
You know,
and it would be
Hugh Grant kind of doing his gosh shucks routine on the bench.
And Richard Curtis would have written it. But coming across
in
Italian...
Here, maybe it's the translation. Maybe it's just the different vibe. It's just that little bit more subtly done.
Yeah,
it's kind of a little minor key film.
Yeah,
it's not a great film. It doesn't kind of shake the world to its foundations. It's a quiet little drama, but it does it just well.
I really, really enjoyed it. I have to say, it was one of those little pleasures that that watching cinema for a living gives you.
And a beautiful ending. And
really cool. And beautiful songs by Rufus Wainwright, by Radiohead, that sometimes work, sometimes don't, that clash. I do warn people that there was one bit that I kind of went, oh...
Yeah, I know exactly the bit you're referring to. And it's not a sort of bit that you get in High School Musical.
No, it isn't. It is a sex scene
which involves
a very hot lady coming around, taking all her clothes off and wearing suspenders.
And slightly violent sex.
Yeah, which I thought, is this a dream sequence?
No, it wasn't a dream sequence. This was Nanny getting it on.
Yeah.
And, you know, this isn't how people are used to seeing Nanny Moretti. And apparently this has caused a bit of a kind of stir in Italy, again, because people just aren't used to seeing him in this
guise. But the whole film is fine. It's all Nanny Moretti, it was all nice, and then suddenly there's the moment.
Kind of...
you wouldn't get that with a Richard Curtis.
Without
film.
Giving too much of the plot away, it kind of makes sense within
the
drama. But it still kind of snaps my eyelids
slightly
open.
Slightly unnecessary. She could have come in and we could have read the sex. We don't need to see it.
Well, or as my you know, dear departed Nan used to say, you just cut away to a shot of the blue sky and you know what's going on, but you don't have to see it.
That's Quiet Chaos or Chaos or Calma. You pronounce it very well.
Yeah, Chaos Calmo.
Chaos Calmo, sì. Molto grazie, Zan. Let's move on to our very different, as you signalled there, third film of the week. High School Musical 3, Senior Year. This finds our lovable heroes, who I've never met before because I've not seen 1 and 2, back in their senior year at their high school. They sing, they dance, they play basketball, and they sing and they dance as they play basketball. Zac Efron's in it, Vanessa Hudgens is in it, and it's all very wholesome stuff.
It's ours, Ryan.
Wait a minute. Miss D said that there's only one scholarship. There's two of us.
We're twins. They're gonna have to take us both. Listen, Kelsey always writes her best songs for Troy and Gabriella. So you make certain we get those songs.
How?
Polish her glasses, buy her some ruby slippers, take her to prom. I don't know. Just do it.
Zan, I haven't seen High School Musical 1 nor 2. I was going to be completely lost, therefore, in number 3, surely.
Absolutely. I couldn't work out what on earth was going on. I mean, I really, you know, just educational standards have clearly hit the wall here. They're just singing for no reason at all. They talk in a way that everything goes up at the end. I don't know whether they had classes in that in High School 1 and 2.
Well, if they did,
in junior year and sophomore year. And frankly, it was nothing like my high school. Nothing like it.
But you didn't grow up in Albuquerque.
I didn't grow up in Albuquerque. But even if I had, I sort of think this film doesn't play on this planet.
Yeah, really. I thought this is really why we hear of those high school massacres in Middle America quite so often.
That's High School Musical 4. It's coming. You can see it in their eyes. There's an incipient madness and psychosis that's ready to break.
The thing was about High School Musical 3, Zan, is that it's really slick. I thought it was
very professionally done indeed.
I mean, if this was Grange Hill, for example, the sets would wobble, everyone would have spots, and the school dinners would be awful. Here, I mean, the wealth on display is just extraordinary.
Yeah, these are wealthy little kids, aren't they? They've been to Bertram Pincus to have their teeth done, and they're flashing those teeth at every opportunity. There's something a bit scary about them, though.
I found it quite. I mean, their wholesomeness was. I found it not the saccharineness of it, because it's all kind of all done, and they dance. I mean, they literally like put a show at the end of year show. They don't go to lessons.
No, they don't go to lessons. They're too busy singing. But I mean, you know, they're wannabe drama students. They want to be, you know, song and dance people.
Do they? But he also wants to be a basketball
star. He wants to be a jock
star.
As well. There is the dilemma at the heart of High School Musical 3 that he doesn't know. He's like little Billy Elliot. He doesn't know, you know,
down
which way
he's or down up in the pits. Gods.
Yeah, exactly. You know, although it is wholesome, although it is the slight kind of fascistic vibe to it, it has to be said that there are a lot of black characters here too.
But I did notice that they only sort of dance with other black characters. Really.
They do, yeah. There's no miscegenation going on.
No,
there.
That would
keep to their own
too much.
And there is a little character called Ryan who is, shall we say, theatrical.
He
in
is,
nature.
Isn't he? Doesn't he have
He's
a way with a hat?
Very theatrical.
Yes.
So there's a certain, you know, stabs at multiculturalism and you know, the great tide pool of American
youth. And I was wondering, there were not many Jewish characters in it. I was expecting, except I thought perhaps that the lead girl, Sharpay, she kind of looked
Sharpay,
a bit...
Sharpay, yeah, she was a bit Jewish American princess,
she
wasn't
looks
she?
Like one. She looks a bit like Bette Midler, but there's no reference to her. And then her parents come in and they look very waspy. So
but there's no actual reference to anything. This is the weird thing
that
has the kind of the visual symbols that you can kind of think... That kid is gay.
Yeah.
That kid might be Jewish. That kid is black, obviously. And yet nothing is actually aired. There's no actual debate or discussion about
this is
any
my
of these
thing.
Issues.
I've always thought High School Musical was our equivalent of the Kids from Fame, which I confess, guilty pleasure, I loved in the day. Not the Alan Parker, just the Alan Parker film, but the series that span off from it. And this is the other way around. This is a series that's spun into a movie. But Fame had, you know, Sweat, literally, in the credits, and Legwarmers, and it was gritty, it was New York.
Yeah,
it was
drugs, it was kids smoking, and the other obvious ancestor, I guess, is something like Grease, and yet Grease had, you know, your teen pregnancy thrown in there. This has none of that. I mean, the characters, it's all about, you know, who's stepping out with who's dating who, are they breaking up? And yet none of these characters ever seem to have any kind of relationship at all. There's barely any kissing. It's, you know, the odd little peck, but that's sort of it. And that's because this is targeted not at teenagers at all. It's certainly not targeted at us, but it's not even targeted as teenagers. This is targeted at sort of 6 to 8-year-olds who maybe have the notion of he's dreamy, you know, she's a bitch, but they don't actually want to get kind of down and dirty with that. You know, we were mentioning earlier on about Dawson's Creek before we started recording. Now, Dawson's Creek is one of those weird teen dramas that's actually pitched at kind of 30-somethings.
Yeah.
It's pitched at people who kind of vaguely remember what it was like to be a teenager and wish that they had the intelligence and the, you know, articulate nature that they have now when they were a teenager, so they could say all these very lofty things and make all these references and things like that. So it's that pure wish fulfillment. This is wish fulfillment coming from a different direction, because it's like little kids who want to be teenagers.
Yeah, but do we want to feel their... I mean, life just isn't like this. I know that, you know, that's the Disney thing, and this is earning a huge amount of money for Disney. It's like $1 billion.
Life isn't like Ghost Town either.
No, it's true. But this is a $1 billion franchise, so if we don't stand up to it slightly,
okay,
here, who will?
Let's stand up to it. Let's ban it.
I know Zac Efron, who's a star who I rather liked in Hairspray, actually.
Yeah.
He has said that he will do no more High School Musicals after this.
What's he going to do? He's graduated, hasn't he?
Well, I don't know.
Senior year.
There's going to have to be High School Musical 4, because
it's going to be the reunion.
As far as I could see, none of them attend any classes. So how on earth are they going to pass their exams without doing any lessons? I do not
know. They'll just be held back, won't they? They'll be like kind of 50
and
sitting there with loads of little kids, and they'll still be dancing, and the kids will just be like attacking them.
And then Ron Howard will do the Cocoon version. Brilliant.
Ron Howard's still in school, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
There bald and, you know, depressed.
Zan, talking to Ron Howard, who kicked off the LFF with Frost Nixon, which we talked about last week, which we both liked, actually, because Ron Howard has clearly graduated and been attending some classes. You've been out and about at the London Film Festival. Just quickly, what have you seen? And then I'll add some things that I've seen so that the good people at home can go and see stuff.
What have I seen? I saw a film that I missed out on at Cannes, Synecdoche, which is the Charlie Kaufman film, which I know that you've seen as well.
Yeah,
which...
I saw it in Synecdoche, New York.
Yes,
yeah.
Synecdoche, New York.
With this fantastic cast.
A brilliant cast and kind of a brilliant film.
Is it?
It's a brilliant film, and yet it's a film that I have no wish to ever sit through again.
I don't think you can.
Yeah, I don't think you can. It's very opaque. It's so melancholic that it kind of wallows in it. It wallows in... mortality. Mortality porn.
It hit a plangent bass note of depression for me, and I thought, God, I mean, it must be hard work being Charlie Kaufman.
It must be, you know, but at least I guess you can put it all on screen and make all of us like Charlie Kaufman, having watched it. I really stumbled out thinking, I'm going to die soon. And what have I achieved?
Yeah, that Disney executive will come along here. You don't like High School Musical 3!
What else have I seen? Il Divo, which is another film that Cannes, which is... Paolo Sorrentino's really rather brilliant sort of portrait of the seven-time Italian Prime Minister Giulio Andreotti.
This is interesting because Moretti, who we spoke about before, did
The Cayman about Berlusconi.
Yeah.
Andreotti, a very, very different beast to Berlusconi. Berlusconi being the kind of the extrovert, kind of playing up the buffoon angle. Andreotti being this real kind of creature of the shadows, just hiding out. And Il Divo is a film that never really kind of attempts to say who this person is, but just circles him and
circles
him.
Do I need to know my Italian politics to see
Il Divo? You really do. You really do. There's like...
I
don't know it, and I still don't know it, having watched it. You know, there's about sort of 50 kind of minor characters who are all introduced by these very quick captions. You know, this is this person, they served on this administration. You're thinking, who? you probably do.
But Sorrentino's such a baffling director at the best of times.
He's a totally baffling director, but
he did The Consequences of Love and The Family Friend.
Yeah. But he's brilliant, and it's this great kind of sweeping Roman epic, really. I mean, like really flamboyant with sort of crash zooms and long tracking shots and slow motion. And just in terms of its choreography, it's superb. Another film that I saw, that you know, a much lesser film that's probably going to slip through unnoticed, but which deserves watching, is El Dorado, which is a little Belgian noirish road movie by a guy called Bully Lanners.
Oh, yes, I saw one of his films before. Can't remember what it was called.
I can't remember it. Don't ask me. We'll edit this bit out. he directs and stars in El Dorado, and it's about two kind of losers, a sort of used car salesman and a petty criminal who go on a kind of journey across Belgium. And
it's a short film, is it?
It's a great film. It could have been twice the length, and I
really
loved it.
It's funny.
It's funny.
I like a Belgian neo-noir road movie.
Yeah, there's not enough of them. There should be. Think of all the roads in Belgium that you could make films on. You know, another films that were at Cannes is The Class, Laurent Cantet.
Which I saw again. It's wonderful.
It's great, isn't it?
It's my second time I've seen it.
This is the real High School.
Exactly. No musical, no. I just thought this was super. I mean, for me, this is how
this is sort of, you know, verite, sort of fly on the wall. I'm totally authentic seeming, absolutely superb. I think Lauren Kante should probably do High School Musical 4, The Reunion.
Yeah. I was at a sort of reception for him, and people were suggesting him for the next Bond, for example, because which I think he was kind of slightly had a sort of thought figure, sort of little flicker
well,
in there.
If they're going to offer it here, you're going to say yes.
Well, you should say, I mean, it would be the biggest, but, you know, he said if I do Bond, then I could then make sort of 14 the classes for the next 14, so I'd be sorted, which would be a good thing, because this is very special stuff. It won the Palme d'Or, France's first Palme d'Or winner for ages, and is released here in hopefully February. I think it could be an Oscar film winner.
It could be.
I just think it's superb. It's about systems. Rather, it's not just about being at school. It's about systems and institutions and how they kind of shape our dreams and kind of limit us and our ambitions. And I just think it's
absolutely superb.
Marvellous stuff.
And another highlight from Cannes for me, which is playing here, is Waltz with Bashir, which is the Israeli animation, which is, again, superbly done. And like the class, kind of totally in charge of its material and knows exactly what it's doing. And that's worth seeing. Looking further ahead, there's Dubia, which is playing next week, I think, which is Oliver Stone's Bush biopic, which I haven't seen yet, but I'm kind of interested.
Interested. I'm just fascinated by the advert that's online with Tandy Newton as Condoleezza Rice.
And... Yeah, it looks like a little bit of it's going to be a lot of impersonations, isn't it?
I'm a bit worried that is, but it could be spitting image, it could be hilarious. Yeah. I don't quite know which way it's going to go. I hear Josh Brolin is fantastic as Bush, and that would be just another kind of, that's where the Oscars are going now. They're kind of becoming, you know, Alistair McGowan's going to get and Rory Bremner are going to get Oscars soon, because it's all about kind of Ray Charles, Helen Mirren,
Idi
Amin, you know, just impersonations are winning the Oscars these days. What happened to acting? Perhaps it's the writing we should be looking at. I caught, Zan, just in case people are out there, I caught Religulous, which is Larry
Charles.
Bill Maher plays the sort of, he's our condied figure through the world of religion. It's an anti-religious film, but it's not an anti-religion as such. It's about the ridiculousness that religion is leading us to, like the end of days scenario and like the winning the election for religion, etc. So it's more a doubting Thomas. It sows the seed of doubt around, although Bill Maher...
Is this going to sow any sees a doubt in people who are religious?
No, not at all. As we'll hear from Larry Charles when the film comes out here on Film Weekly, I don't think he ever convinced anyone, nor did they convince him that God existed. So I think that's the kind of problem that the film had. That said, it is very funny in a Borat-y kind of way occasionally. And I also saw, which I recommend to anyone who's out and about, a film called Frozen River, a US indie film. I think they're making a little bit of a revival, those US indie films.
There's a sort of the mumblecore aspect. Is this, I was mumbling that, is this mumblecore or is this more kind of...
This is more kind of traditional US indie.
Like not sort in of the, Old Joy kind
yes,
of style?
Yes, much more like Kelly Reichardt's
I liked Old Joy.
Yes, I did. And Wendy and Lucy by Kelly Reichardt, starring Michelle Williams, is in the festival as well. This was about a woman in the snowy wastes of upstate New York who transports illegal immigrants across the border from Canada using Indian reservations which aren't subject to normal US law. It was fascinating. A location I've never seen before, starring actors I've never seen before, people I've never seen before. And I thought that's the kind of nice surprise I'd like to have had. There's another US film called Ballast as well, which is kind of touted very highly at Sundance. And I didn't quite enjoy that one so much, I have to say, which was what I thought I would be the other way around. So I didn't like Ballast. I really liked Frozen River. So let us know if you've seen that and what you thought of it.
So we're kind of midway through the festival now. Are you thinking this is a good festival?
I'm thinking this is a long festival, which is what I always think at this time. And I'm wondering, I'm enjoying it very much.
I think it's a good vintage this year.
But who is it for, this festival? Because most of my friends who live in London say it's still going on.
Well, this is always the thing. And you do something on The Guardian, you say this festival's going on, and people just, you know, post comments on the blog saying, you know, I live in Leeds, you know, what's that to me?
Yeah,
kind of thing.
Exactly.
But that's the problem you're going to get with every festival.
But you don't get that in Cannes.
No,
because
people in Cannes can't go to the festival in Cannes.
Yeah.
This is the thing. London has thrown open its doors. You know, the least they can do is get a train ticket down from Leeds to come.
It is worth doing, because you can see stuff.
Yeah.
But the festival goes on for ages. I will give it a final roundup next week. I think it is a good festival. I just wish there was something we could do about getting everyone so excited about it as we are. Zan, thank you very much indeed. You can read all of Zan's reviews from the London Film Festival and much, much more, the wealth of news and reviews that he gives us, other Guardian critics included too, at www.guardian.co.uk/film. And now it's time for all you boys to put on a skirt or maybe just a vest, and for the ladies to back comb their hair and tear their fishnets as we enter the world of Depeche Mode. Posters Came From the Walls is a painfully honest, humorous and intimate examination of Depeche Mode fandom around the world. The documentary starts out in St. Petersburg, Russia, where, coincidentally, Depeche Mode's lead singer Dave Gahan shares his birthday, the 9th of November, with the Russian national holiday, Victory Day. This national celebration of the military has been co-opted since the early 1990s as Depeche Mode Day by devotees of the band. The documentary is the work of Turner Prize-winning artist and filmmaker Jeremy Deller and his co-director Nick Abrahams. And at the world premiere of their film at the London Film Festival last week, I caught up with a duo to learn more about this fascinating project. I'm with directors Jeremy Deller and Nick Abrahams after the premiere, the world premiere of their new film, The Posters Came From the Walls, about the obsession of Depeche Mode fans for their subject, Depeche Mode. Congratulations, guys. It's just premiered at the LFF, and I suppose it must have been an extremely exciting evening for you, except you seemed so nervous beforehand. I was a bit worried for you.
Well, you never know quite how something's going to be received, because you're so used to seeing it. And you see every fault in it, and when it's enlarged on a screen, you just think, oh my goodness, does it really look like that? And, but to be honest, I couldn't believe the reaction from people. I was so happy with how they received it. So
it was interesting to me, Jeremy, that afterwards you said you weren't aware that you'd made a comedy, and that happens quite often to filmmakers. The first time they see an audience react, and you had 400 people in there, they were laughing. Were you concerned that was the wrong message?
I think that people initially, when they see a film, are a bit nervous and they don't know how to react, so they just think everything's going to be a bit funny. And they calmed down a bit. That doesn't mean they didn't find bits of it funny or amusing, but I think initially they just thought this was going to be a funny film, and it isn't. There are very funny moments to it, but it's quite varied in that respect.
I think there's also with fandom, or you know, devotees, there's an element of always looking at other people and thinking they're a bit weird because they're fans of Depeche Mode in this instance. But part of the thing in the film is we're all a bit like that. You know, just to different levels, maybe.
Yeah, and I suppose the expectation is that if you're making a film about fans, then it's going to be, you're going to take the piss or have a go at them, and we weren't going to do that, but I think maybe there's that level of expectation, but it wasn't the case.
Yeah, I think it kicks off here in in Basildon, and that is a funny word anyway, Basildon, so it's going to get a laugh. But you know, to think of that, how the music came from this place, it is extraordinary to think of how it's actually spread out as music. But it is I suppose a study of Depeche Mode fans. It's quite specific what this documentary does. It isn't a study of Depeche Mode themselves or their music. It's what it means to people in Mexico, in São Paulo, in Russia, in Romania, and here under Hammersmith Bridge.
Well, yeah, I think there's been enough films about their history, and the history is pretty well known. So I think it's a time to like turn the camera around the other way and film the people that buy the CDs and watch the films about them, and just see what they felt about the band and how it affected their lives.
Why this in particular? Why not football fans? Why Depeche Mode fans, Nick?
They're just quite an unusual phenomenon, I think. There is this thing that they're huge around the world. I mean, much bigger than you realise, much bigger than their record sales, because of so much of their success was behind the Iron Curtain before they had any, you know, any merchandise or records or anything for sale. But also they're this electronic band. It was this idea of electronics covering the world.
And Jeremy, I was wondering how this work sort of chimes with what you've done before.
I did something about Manic Street Preachers fans in 97. An exhibition about them, and I work with a lot of their fans, and I've always been interested in people who are enthusiastic about something, be it music, be it politics, art, whatever, so it kind of fits in. But my trajectory as an artist is so bizarre anyway that virtually anything can fit in this respect.
Yeah, and I wonder if you search you've interviewed so many fans, what it is that makes people fans, what it is that the fandom fills in their lives, that they go screaming, that they devote so much time to a certain object, be it Jesus, be it the Depeche Mode.
Yeah, but part of the thing in the film, I think, is that the different fans use the band in different ways and in different cultures as well. They use them in very different ways. And so it's quite a personal use of the band and the music.
And they seem to appeal to people who are in troubled situations, either personally or in terms of politically. They've always been appealed to sort of, you know, disaffected teenagers in Southern California or people going through great hardship in Russia. They've always been a kind of comfort to people, and I think that's really great.
It's lovely to see you. I saw Steve McQueen's Hunger, Turner winning prize artist, David the other night, Sam Taylor Wood's short. You artists are taking over this London Film Festival.
We did actually aim to make quite a straight documentary in a way. It was meant to be a documentary, it wasn't meant to be some kind of art film. Is that right?
Absolutely not. I didn't want to make some arty film. I just wanted to make I love documentaries. It's almost my favourite thing in the world. So I just wanted to make a classic documentary.
Classic music documentary.
Yeah, sorry, classic music documentary.
No, well, I think you have. I think you have, and I think that spirit was actually the right matching of content and form, and that's presumably what art does at its best. So well done, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jeremy Deller and Nick Abrahams there, and as yet there's no UK release for The Posters Came from the Walls. Of course, we were the first to see it, so we bring you the news, freshest and newest, here on Film Weekly. But do keep track of the project by keeping an eye on Mute Records' website. That's www.mute.com. And that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks to all my guests, to Sharon Maguire, to Jeremy Deller, to Nick Abrahams and to Zan Brooks. Remember to pick up a copy of this week's Observer to catch my Trailer Trash column, bringing you all the best tidbits and reviews from the LFF. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.